A book of the Bible that has been a mystery to many over the years is the book of Job. It is an ancient book, but it has some very important lessons for us today. Why does God allow his servants to suffer at times, and why do some suffer more than others? This book raises questions. It also reveals answers as well. So today I'd like to look at the questions and the answers that we might find here and discover maybe some newer things too in the book of Job. Let me give you some background before we actually get into the book, and I'm not going to, it's 42 chapters long, and we're not going to read 42 chapters today. I don't have enough time. I got to go back to Fort Myers. No. this is one of the things I tried to really be careful about is picking here and there to give you a flavor of what's going on to see what we can learn from the book of Job. The book of Job, in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and the man was blameless, upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil, or turned away from evil is what that means. The only other place the name Job appears is in Genesis 46 and in verse 13. I won't turn there to save time, but he is listed there as a son of Issachar, one of the 12 sons of Jacob. And we've assumed that that is the same Job, which is interesting too because of the time period it puts Job in the period of the patriarchs. And yes, even before the time of Moses, he may have lived into some of the time of Moses, but I'll come to that here in just a moment. Job is an actual character. In Ezekiel chapter 14, I will turn there, and verse 14 and verse 20 it repeats. In Ezekiel 14, now this is many, many centuries after the death of Job when you get to Ezekiel, because he was one of the early captives around 600 B.C. Job probably goes clear back to 1600 B.C., about 1,000 years earlier than Ezekiel in time. If you go back to the time of the patriarchs and when they came down to Egypt. Ezekiel 14:14. Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God, in this captivity. In verse 20, it says, it repeats it once again, those three, Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it. As I live, says the Lord God, they would deliver neither son nor daughter. They would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. So we see he is an actual character, and he is a righteous man. And this is reported of him about 1,000 years later, after his time or when he may have been born. In the book of James, I'm going to read this because it's also important, in the letter of James, which we've covered already in Bible study. I don't know if I said it when we came to James, but in James chapter 5 and verse 11, it says, indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. The end or the end result from the word teleos here that is used is what it's talking about. The end, you've seen the end result. Well, that is certainly a reason for this book being written, so that we would see it. If it wasn't written, we wouldn't see it. We wouldn't even know a thing about it, would we? So coming back to Job once again, that is to the beginning of it, the book breaks down into seven divisions, interestingly. Chapters 1 and 2 is the introduction, and it's very important in that introduction, as you'll see. Then you have three series of arguments or controversies between Job and his three friends. And the first one is Job 3 through 14. The second one is Job 15 through 21, and the third one is Job 22 through 31. At the end of chapter 31, Job then ceases to speak. The fifth section or division then is an individual who comes along we haven't heard of up until that point. His name is Elihu. He speaks for five chapters, 32 through 37. Number six division is chapters 38 through 41. Now God speaks. And then finally, chapter 42 is the conclusion of the matter. It's always been, if you read anything about the book of Job, it's a certain mystery to commentaries and people trying to understand everything about it. But I think, every time you go back through the book of Job, there's things I think you see, and it's purposely written that way because God wants us to study it, pray about it, and discover some of the things that would apply to our generation and to us personally each time that we go back through it. He doesn't just say, now here's why, this was what Job's problem was, and, ABC, so that, no, he wants you to search, to seek, and to see if we can't discover a little bit more. Let me give some of the historical background things here. Issachar was around 40 years of age, the son of Jacob, when he and the rest of the family went to Egypt. When they went to Egypt, the Pharaoh that was Pharaoh at the time that Joseph, of course, was there, was not an Egyptian. He was a Hyksos, and which was important to know, because they had freedom. They lived in the best land, that is, Israelites did, in the land of Goshen to raise the livestock and everything that was an abomination to the Egyptians to do. I mention that because that allowed any of them the freedom to leave. And apparently Job did as a young man to wind up in the land of Uz, which is somewhere between, and I'll read a comment on that in just a moment, between Damascus and the Arabian Desert. Job would have been about 20 years of age when he would have gone down there somewhere, give or take a year or two, whatever. But sometime in the next 50 years, Job went to the land of Uz, and he would have had the freedom to leave under the Hyksos. Later, about 1570 BC, the Egyptians overthrew the Hyksos rulers. They were, and when they did, they enslaved the Israelites in the land of Goshen. Why? Well, because the Israelites looked like the Hyksos, and they did not want any rising up of, quote, Hyksos, because they saw the families who were like them. I don't know if they were Assyrian descent, the Hyksos, or just exactly what they were. They were of the line of Shem, and they were not like the Egyptians. So the Egyptians, fearing these people that are multiplying out here, now we've overthrown the Hyksos pharaohs, and we're going to make sure these people do not rise up and throw us out again, or for the first time for them to do that. So that's when they became enslaved. It would have been impossible for them to up and leave the land of Goshen freely after that took place. the time period of when they went down to Egypt would have been approximately 1650 BC. Interesting thing at the end of Job, the book of Job in chapter 42, verse 10, and again in 16, God, because of everything, he doubled what Job had before. And of course, the question has been, did he also double his age? And because it says it gave him 140 years more, or not, it says just he had lived another 140 years. Was that double 70? That would have meant he lived a total of 210 years, which would have been pretty close to what the patriarchs did. Was it Isaac or Jacob lived to be 180? I forgot. I know Abraham was 175. And so that may be possible, that may have taken place. So where does this figure out in some of the history back in the book of Genesis and Exodus time-wise? Well, if he did, let's say indeed it was not just double in children, double in livestock and all that, that he and also doubled in his age. When Joseph... If it is correct, then he was probably born soon, that is, Job born soon after Joseph was sold into Egypt, just to give you some time frame. He would have died approximately 120 years after the death of Joseph. He lived to be 210. When Joseph died, Job would have been about 90 years old. And Job would have died when Moses was about 55 years old. Moses had been in Midian, already for 15 years. He was fleeing the Egyptians, remember that? And he was in the wilderness at Midian, which was 25 years before the Exodus. Approximately 25 years before the Exodus, if God doubled his years of life, he would have died 25 years before the Exodus. He wouldn't have been in it. He was not in the land of Goshen. He was a king in the land of Uz, and we'll see that later, particularly in the 29th chapter of the book of Job. And he had, which is why he was, and he was also the most righteous man in the East. Okay, a little bit here. One other thing about an archaeological note from Merrill Unger's book, Archaeology in the Old Testament. Uz is a land and its people located somewhere in the Syrian desert between the latitudes of Damascus on the north and Edom on the south. Edom at that time would have been all the way to Petra. The land is best remembered as the home of Job, chapter 1, verse 1, who was exposed to attacks by the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans. You'll see that in chapter 1. In Jeremiah's day, the Edomites dwelt there, and it's mentioned in Lamentations 4, verse 21. Okay, now let's go to the book of Job and read a little bit. I'll read probably the most verses of any chapter will be in the first two, and then we will be hitting spots along the way as we go forward. Well, I read verse 1, verse 2, and he had 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also, his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people in the East. And when you say East here, it's not what, east of the Euphrates River in this case. At that time, we're talking about east from the land of Canaan and more of a desert location. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. We find that the family always got together to eat and to drink. It's quite regular here as you go through these first 2 chapters, or at least the first chapter. So it was that when the days of feasting had run their course, and Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly. I wonder why this, because later his own wife will tell him, "Well, curse God and die, Job," at the end of chapter 2. why would you want to curse God? Deceived by the devil, I guess. Now, there was a day in verse 6 when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. I remember Joel Meeker using one of these verses said, now don't ask me why Satan is able to go before God when the angels meet. Again, I can't answer that either. But it's interesting in verse 7, and the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." Verse 8, then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns or turns away from evil?" Now let's stop here as we're getting into this whole story. Why would God ask Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" You have thought about that? Well, of course, he already knows. God knows what kind of answer he's going to get back from Satan. It's going to be arrogant, sarcastic almost, and everything. You let me work him over a bit, and he'll curse you to your face. Well, why? He didn't ask the question for Satan's sake, did he? God was considering Job. But he asked Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Because God's already been considering his servant Job. And God is so far ahead of Satan. He sees something here. He says, look, he's a blameless man. He's upright. He's all of these things that I've just read, previous verses, of his character, what kind of a man and individual he is. But God is still considering Job. And he poses the question. The angels have come in some sort of a conference, let's call it, together at a certain time. And Satan apparently was able to come and be there. And so he put the question to Satan. And, well, verse 9, so Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Yes, he has. Nothing wrong with that. Verse 11, but now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, well, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord to carry that out. Let me just tell you what happens in the next few verses so I don't have to read all of them. All of his livestock is soon taken. His servants are killed who were watching over them. It gets down to about verse 18 and 19 to the sons. While he was still speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine, again, in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind, cyclone or tornado, came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house and fell on the young people, and they are all dead. So at the end of verse 19, Job has lost everything, hasn't he? He is probably one of the richest individuals in the East, as well as one of the most righteous, if you will, of people that lived in the East. Verse 20, Job arose, tore his robes, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away, and blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Remarkable man, isn't he? As Ezekiel would say, a righteous man. So why would God let all this happen? But we're not through. As you go into chapter 2, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan a second time, from where do you come? And then he said in verse 3, the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Second time he's brought the question up. Verse 3, though, adds a little something else, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless, upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. Now here is an interesting point. The word integrity. He holds fast to his integrity. Ask yourself, can you think of any other servant in the Bible who holds fast to his integrity? What is integrity? Well, it is honor. It is character. It is also innocence, by the way, from the Hebrew word. It is uprightness. So he holds to his innocence. He holds to his uprightness. He holds to his honor. Whose honor? His. Right? You'll notice that through the book as we keep going. And here also in verse 3, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you, Satan, incited me, God, against him. I allowed you to do this. What he's saying to Satan, to destroy him without cause. Well, of course, Satan comes back. He doesn't realize God's playing him, as we might say in our language today. Simply using him. So he said, well, look, skin for skin, you let me do something to him, and of course he will curse you to your face, verse 5. So, and the Lord said, Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Again, you see this word keeps coming up. Curse God and die. Well, he did not, but he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" And all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He did not sin with his lips. But again, have you considered my servant Job? Because God is obviously considering his servant Job by the fact that he brought the question up now twice. Now from verse 11 to the end of the chapter, his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, hear about this, and they come to his aid. Of course, as we will see, it's not exactly the kind of aid that you and I would ever want, and certainly Job didn't want it either, because as we will see, they equate any kind of loss like this that obviously you have done evil, and this is punishment that you are about to receive. And oh, do they ever give it to him. I'll let you read the chapters where these individuals speak. The one who speaks the most demeaning of all is the first one, Eliphaz. And later at the end of the book, God said in chapter 42, "You pray for your three friends and for Eliphaz that they might live." God was listening. He allowed it. He was listening. And because Job prayed for his friends, they were spared, and Job was blessed double wise. All right, now let's go to chapter 3, and here we'll start just hitting a couple verses at a time. Verse 1, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. You have to put yourself and try to be in Job's place in one sense. I mean, if you have boils all over your body, and you've lost everything you owned and had, and you've lost even all your children who you prayed for and made sacrifices for just in case they did things cursed God or whatever, and it's all gone, what state of mind would you be in? Would you not be possibly a little depressed? Yes. In other words, he wishes, as you read on here, that he were dead, that he didn't have to keep living day in and day out experiencing all of this pain, both the mental pain and the physical pain that he was going through. Verse 11 and 13 here, just to get some flavor. Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breast that I should nurse? Verse 13, for now I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. Then I would have been at rest. I would have mental rest and peace, as well as physical. And then at the end of the chapter, verse 25, for the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. Now, what was it that he greatly feared in this case that has come upon him? We know what's come upon him, but did he fear that and before it ever happened? Maybe so. So we see the man is suffering. When we get to chapter 4, here we have Eliphaz the Temanite, who is a son of Esau, and he comes to give, by the way, it's interesting where these people came from, showing you basically the overall region of where Uz would have been located, because the Temanites were the sons of Esau and would have been where the Edomites were at that time, with their main city being at Petra. Later they would move on. Now in chapter 4, in verse 7 and 8, Eliphaz says, remember now, whoever perished being innocent, which means what? Job, you're not innocent. Just fess up. Or where were the upright ever cut off? even verse 8, as I have seen, those who plow iniquity sow trouble, reap the same. So here you begin to get the flavor of what is quite condemning of him. They miss a major factor which Jesus Christ brought out. And let me just point this out, because I think sometimes even church members may think the same thing to some degree of this. In Luke, the 13th chapter, and in the first five verses, well, maybe I better read it so I get it right, but I'll quickly turn over here. Luke 13, and in verse 1, there were present at that season some who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered and said to them, do you suppose that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered such things? Well, I tell you, no, they weren't. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. He goes on there talking a little bit more, but also in John 9 and verse, I'll just tell you what John 9, 33 and 34 says. He healed the man who was blind from birth, put a mud pack on his head, said, go down to the pool of Siloam. It was on the Sabbath. It was on the last day of the feast in 30 AD. And when the Pharisees saw it, and all the man could say, because he was so filled with joy that he could see for the first time in his life. And he said, I don't know, but he just, they wanted to know, who did this? Who did this on the Sabbath? And their comment when he said, well, all I know is I went down to the pool of Siloam, and now I can see. I couldn't see before, and it was Jesus that did it. I believe he gives the name there as well. And they said, who are you to talk to us? You were born in sin. You see how the people thought, and people to this day think, if something bad, as we would look at it, happens or comes on people, you've done something. And of course, they were accused, and they put him out of the synagogue, didn't they? You might remember the story there. And that's why Jesus asked, you think those Galileans were great, were more sinners than these others? I tell you, no, they weren't. Now, coming back to the book of Job with that in mind, that's here you see this with these Eliphaz and his two friends, and how they're questioning Job. Let's drop to chapter 4, verse 17 through 19. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his maker? Well, no, of course not. But they're implying that you, Job, think you are. If he puts no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before a moth? Now, of course, he knew what happened to his daughters there. Obviously, Eliphaz did in the last verse 19, making this reference. In other words, this wouldn't have happened unless you had done something wrong. All right, we're going to move along here. I don't want to spend a lot of time on these discourses because we want to get to more of the heart of the problem as we go through this. Skipping chapter 5. In chapter 6, just a couple verses there that I want to look at. Verse 14. In chapter 6, Job is speaking here. To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty, referring to his friend forsaking the fear of the Almighty. It's a good point to be made. That's why I wanted to read verse 14. Job speaking, to him who is afflicted, myself, he's saying, kindness should be shown by his friend. You're not showing any kindness or sympathy or understanding or anything. You're just accusing me and really, really making everything worse. I'm suffering enough as it is. That's what he's trying to say. Verse 24, teach me, Job says, and I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred. Job is asking a question here. And he's asking, really, in one sense, the wrong question. Show me why this is happening. I want to know why. And you'll see this throughout the remainder of the book. Job is failing to ask, really, the important questions. He should not be asking why. And it's a lesson for all of us. He is, and he wants to argue, as you're going to see. He wants to reason with God. Why this has happened? I've done nothing. I'm an upright man. I hold to my integrity. But Job should be asking, how can I draw closer to God? How can I draw closer? Yes, and he should be asking, what more can I do? And it goes along with the sermonette. that's enough. How do you phrase that? No, it isn't. We should always be asking, what more can I do? Especially when it comes to serving God. What more can I do? How can I draw closer to God? Because when we start asking, and when I want God to tell me why, we're challenging God. We want to really, what he wants to do is argue with God. And you'll see that as we go along. In verse 29, yield now, let there be no injustice. Yes, concede, my righteousness still stands. All right. He's an upright man. He is a righteous man. whose righteousness is it? And, you know, as you go through this, it's quite interesting because in the end, God never accuses him of anything. But he leaves the door open for both Job and all who read the book to discover what was it that was missing, because God was considering his servant Job before he ever asked the question to Satan. All right, moving along and make some time here. Chapter 7. I only want to look at verse 20 in chapter 7. and Job is continuing to speak here. Have I sinned? What have I done to you, God, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Now he's blaming God here for all of this that's come upon him. Yes, God has allowed it. That's true. And you have to remember the scripture. Of course, Job wouldn't have had a Bible period, but he somehow was close to God enough so that he knew what it was to be upright and how to live, at least outwardly, a righteous life. But in 1 Corinthians 10:13, God will not try us in that which we cannot handle. Or maybe I better read it because, I'm sorry, didn't get it all quoted correctly, but in, 10:13? No temptation, that's what I want to say. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Now that principle and that statement should be kept in mind here. God understood that with Job. You know, it says in the Bible that in Isaiah 46 and in verse 10, that I declare the end from the beginning. God knew before this all began. He knew what kind of answer Satan would give him. And he knew what Job could handle. Even though Job, in his mind, if only I could die. But also God knew that it was going to take something to really get Job to come to the point where he saw what he was blind to throughout the entire book. And it's obviously very important for all of us. Well, I'll give you a little hint. My integrity. What about God's? My righteousness. Is it mine or is it God's? He didn't understand that. He wanted to reason with God, it's my integrity. And sometimes people get that way. And down through the years, people, went to the Pharisees, weren't they that way? They had a phylactery on their arm. All the good things they did. Their righteousness. Of course, it was silly. But notice the thinking. Even the people in the time when Jesus came. Do you think those Galileans were worse sinners than whoever else? No. Absolutely not. But do you think people think that way today and have some of those? Well, certainly they do. That's why we have it here in the Bible for us to learn from. All right, moving right along, let's go to skip chapter 8. And in chapter 9, Job answers in verse 21. I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. Again, notice all these things. I'm picking out certain verses so we see how Job looks at himself, that I have not sinned. I've done nothing wrong. Why isn't God blessing me? Why does he bring this upon me? Who said he did? He allowed it. Satan actually is the one who directly brought it upon him and did it. But God allowed it, and yet God is going to work everything out, as we'll see as we go along. In chapter 10, verse 1 and 2, my soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul and my whole being, that I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. But that's an assumption. It's an assumption because he looks at things in the sense that God is not fair. God is not being fair. Has anybody ever thought that kind of thought, maybe, that God is not fair? You know, sometimes when people have had things happen to them, they do. Things far less than what Job is going through. And they may think, God isn't fair. They lose somebody, they lose a loved one, they have something happen to them, things of that nature. Sometimes those thoughts will be there and they'll have to take time wrestling with that and praying and coming to the point where they realize, yes, God is fair and he knows what he's doing. He is in charge. But Job wants to argue the point and try to make his point with God. In chapter 12, skipping 11, verse 1, then Job answered and he said, no doubt you are the people with wisdom. No doubt you are the people and wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you, you three friends of mine. Indeed, who does not know such things as these? I am one mocked by his friends, who called on God and he answered him. He, the just and the blameless, who is ridiculed. And of course he was many, many times. But he's finally beginning to fight back. He will not take this. One thing about Job, Satan is using his three friends to break him down and make him doubt. And he's resisting all of that. And of course, in doing that, he is failing to see that there is something that God is considering in his servant Job for all of this to even be going on. let's go, excuse me, I'm sorry. Let's go forward to chapter 13, verses 2 through 5, verse 2. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you, talking to his three friends, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. But you forgers of lies, you are all worthless physicians. Well, give it to him, Job, in that sense, I agree with you. And verse 5, oh, that you would be silent, and it would be your wisdom to shut up. He's quite upset. Well, he's in pain. He's in constant irritation and pain. He can't sleep at night. And one of the verses later, it actually says, I can't sleep at night. I'm awake all the time. And my life is both mentally, emotionally, and physically, it is terrible and miserable. And to hear this stuff coming from you, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, just gets me angry. But there was a statement there. We said, I want to reason with God in verse 3. I desire to reason with God. And we'll find out God will actually come down and reason with him in a way he would not have expected. All right, chapter 14, of course, ends the first discourse between Job and his three friends. One thing I'll point out in chapter 14, I don't have it marked in this Bible, that if a man dies, shall he live again? Yes, verse 14. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait till my change comes. We use that in funeral services. But it also tells us he understood a great deal of truth. He knew that he believed in the resurrection and that would come one day. All right, we'll go to the chapter 15 and verse 6. Eliphaz, the Temanite, speaking once again. Your own mouth condemns you, Job, and not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you. Well, Eliphaz, how? Well, because you want to reason with God is probably what he would have said if he was more specific about it. But again, he's accusing Job, and he's trying to say to him here in verse 6 that your own mouth condemns you and not I. It's not me. It's Job, it's you. And maybe you've run into people that have treated you somewhat that way at times too. Chapter 16, verse 2. I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all, he says. And then in verse 11, God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over to the hands of the wicked. He's getting pretty upset, isn't he? And I think rightfully so here. In chapter 17, verse 1, my spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me. You know, there have been times in the church when you run into Christians who are going through things and they, if only I could die, I wished I did not have to live through this and that death would come soon. I've talked with people and maybe some of you at times have felt that way when things that you had to go through. Certainly you see this here with Job, trying to be understanding of Job a little bit and what he is going through. I'll skip chapter 18 and chapter 19. We're making progress here. Chapter 19 and verse 19 on. All my close friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me. My bones cling to my skin and to my flesh. I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. And they were after his death. And this is the book. Interesting that they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever to be preserved and not be lost. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at the last on the earth. Yes. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh or apart from my flesh, I shall see God. It's interesting, the last two verses there, his understanding. And he knew about his Redeemer coming. There wasn't a Bible when he lived, and yet he knew about the Redeemer, and his Redeemer is coming, and that he lives. Very interesting points that are put in there as we go along. All right, let me move along. As we go to chapter 23, again, Job speaking. I just want, again, to see a little bit here. And verses 1 through 4, then Job answered, and he said, even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. Before I want to come to God, and I want to talk to him face to face. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. Yes, I believe you would. At least you thought you would at that point in time. God wanted to make his case with God, not humble himself with prayer and fasting. And that's another point. You read the entire book of Job in your Bible study sometime and see how many times you find the word prayer, praying, or fasting. You won't find it. The only place you find the word prayer is at the end when God told him to pray for his three friends. All through the discourses, there's nothing about day. Now, he is sitting in sackcloth and ashes, which sometimes indicated fasting, that they would do that in that period of time. But we have nothing that says that that's what he was doing it for, most likely because of the boils and trying to find something soft that he could be able to sit on and get some comfort. And of course, he couldn't really at that, but at least it's better than sitting on a hard board, which would have been extremely painful and worse. But you never see anything about prayer and fasting. When David, what did he do? Psalm 51. All of God's servants, when they made mistakes or did whatever they did, something went wrong, they turned to God with prayer and fasting. But I don't see that in the book of Job. Now, it's possible that it was there, but it's not written of. But that's the point is that I don't see it in writing. He did. You read Psalm 35, David, verse 13, I think it is. He went to God in fasting and prayer. He afflicted his soul, meaning that he fasted. And we don't see that. He is not trying to humble himself before God. He wants to argue with God that you have done this. You have done this to me, and it's unjust on your part. That's the whole point that he's making in his thinking and in his speech. In Job 27 and verse 5 and 6, far be it from me that I should say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. Really? My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Real stubbornness there coming in, that I'm going to hold and cling to my righteousness. Job 29 is where you begin to see that most likely he is indeed a king because of the descriptions given just to quickly go over it, verse 9 and 10, the princes refrained from talking, that is to me, and put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed. Their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth when they saw me with all the boils. The princes no longer came to me. Who do princes go to? Those under them or those over them? And the voice of the nobles was hushed, and so on, as it went on to say there. verse 21 and 23, just to give you, men listened to me, they used to, and waited and kept silence for my counsel. And after my words, they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. In other words, I was a counselor, and the princes would come to me. What does that tell us? If the princes came to you and you were a counselor, and all these people won't even look at you anymore, they're shunned away because of your state and what has happened to you. And of course, he is greatly grieved over that. In chapter 30, a couple more verses, and then we get to Elihu. In chapter 30, verse 20 and 21, I cry out to you, but you do not answer me. I stand up and you don't hear my prayers. I cry out to you. I guess that would be the prayers when he says what he means when I cry out to you. Verse 21, but you have become cruel to me, and with the strength of your hand you oppose me. Yeah, you've done this to me. How could you do this, God? Now, God, we learn, who cannot lie and cannot sin. But really, when you think about it, he's saying that this is sin because you are doing this to me, and I've been upright. I hold to my integrity. I will not give up on my righteousness. In other words, as we said a few verses back. And finally, chapter 31, and in verse 40, then let thistles grow instead of wheat. What did I just do wrong here? Something is not right in this Bible I'm looking at. Job 31 and verse 40. Well, I've got something different. I changed Bibles when I came here in Job 31. I'm sorry. 31 verse 40. Yeah, that is 31 verse 40, but that's not what it said in the other Bible. It should say, and the words of Job ended at verse 40. Is that in your Bible? Oh, there it is. Okay, you're right. I looked at that. I'm looking here at verse 40. It's written in poetry form. And I brought a different Bible than what I was preparing this in. And yes, you're right. The words of Job are ended. That's what I wanted to tell you. And now in chapter 32 and in verse 1, we have a new character on the scene who's younger than the other three that were older than Job. You know, there's times sometimes when the older people are not as wise. And those three, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, were not. They were all older than Job at the time. But Elihu is a younger man. He kept his mouth shut, as you will read here. But he has more wisdom than they do. So verse 32, chapter 32, so these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. He was righteous in his own eyes. We see this all throughout, don't we? Was he righteous? Yes, but he was righteous in his own eyes. And that is what God was considering in his servant Job. Now, Elihu, verse 2, gets very angry here with the friends. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachal, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. Also against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer, and yet they condemned Job. Now, because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited until to speak to Job, waited until the end. In verse 8, and there is a spirit in man, Elihu says here, and the breath of him Almighty gives him understanding. and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. There is a spirit in man, one of the scriptures in the Bible about the spirit in man that sets man apart. That's why I read that. All right, chapter 33, we'll just quickly go along here. We're almost coming to an end. Chapter 33, verse 8 and 9, "Surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your words, saying, I am pure without transgression, I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me." Of course, this is Elihu speaking of how Job is looking at himself. And in verse 12, "Look, in this you are not righteous, and I will answer you, for God is greater than man." And Job, you are not equal to God. You're not equal to God. You have said you want to reason with God. You said you will cling to your integrity and you will never let it go. Yes, you are outwardly a righteous and upright man. But you take it all the credit to yourself. And you don't realize that God is greater than you. in chapter 34, verse 37 through 37, verse 34. "Men of understanding say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge." He's kind of concluding his remarks almost here. "His words are without wisdom. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin." Why? Because he justifies himself and he is stubborn. And he thinks he is equal to God. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Yeah, well, those are some pretty strong things to say about God that we've looked at as we've gone along. Okay, let's get down here to the section number 6, which begins in Job 38. And we begin to get to the conclusion of the matter. You know, God took a lot of chapters. This is a long book, isn't it? Long book to tell us all something. To tell human beings in every generation something. He's orchestrating. He's behind. He's observing. He's watching. And he has considered his servant Job long before any of this happened. Yes, he speaks highly of his servant Job. But he sees that his servant Job is missing a very important point. And that's what it's for all of us and for Job to come to discover. In chapter 38 and verse 1, "Then the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind, and he said, Who is this who darkens counsel? By words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? And when the morning stars, the angels sang together in unity, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." God is now speaking to him out of a cloud or a whirlwind here. And I'm going to have you answer me, Job. I want you to do some thinking and consideration. God now shows Job that he does not know what he is talking about when he challenges and questions God. these four chapters, God uses everything in the outer space, the stars, the figures that you and I can see, the seven stars, he mentions them here, and all of that. Who made all of that? Who created all of that? Do you understand the laws that keep it in motion? Do you understand the laws of animals rutting? You will read about that if you go through those four chapters. That in the right season they come, they will lay their eggs if they are birds, and when they grow up and leave the nest, they will never return. Who created all that? Who did all of that? It's really interesting as God goes through telling Job, giving him the evidence that he does exist in these four chapters. And I want you, when you see all I have done, you think this happened by time and chance? Well, we have a bunch of people on this earth today who want to say that. and deny any kind of intelligent design. He lays out intelligent design in those four chapters. And I'm that intelligence, is what he is saying. All right, let me just quickly finish up here, and we get to the whole point that we're coming to. Chapter 39, let's see, let's go to chapter 40. You can fill in some of the spots, especially the end of it, by the way. Read what God had to say to Job. You know what Job, his position all along was, I'm holding to my integrity. His three friends, quote unquote, all along were saying, no, you did something, you've done something evil, you had it coming. And back and forth, all of that. But wait, get down to chapters 38 through chapter 40 or 41. And it's, I think, very good and interesting reading of what God then begins to say. Okay, chapter 40, verse 1. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Well, you remember reading that that's basically what he wanted to do. He who rebukes God, let him answer it. And then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth and shut up, is what I'm saying. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. I now see myself. Verse 6 and 8, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, now prepare yourself like a man. A second time, I will question you and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? And all along in his conversations with those three friends, that kept coming out. Well, finally we get to chapter 42, to the conclusion of the matter. In chapter 42 and in verse 6, therefore, Job says, I abhor myself, I repent in dust and ashes. I thought he was holding to his integrity, that he was upright, honorable, righteous. And I will remember, what was it, chapter 27? I'll never let it go. See how merciful God is? Some people would think that lightning would come down and strike him dead for making some of those statements. But God was merciful. And he showed him, he did come down, he spoke to him through a whirlwind of a cloud. Job came to see himself. You know, God didn't say it. Did you see anywhere there that Job, you are such and such? No, he never accused Job of anything. So let me summarize this. First, we have Satan. He arrogantly thought that Job would curse God to his face when oppressed. Of course, God knew that he wouldn't, and Satan was wrong. Job's three friends, well, they thought that great sufferings means there is great guilt and sin. There has to be great guilt and sin if there's great suffering, if things have happened to you like that. Sometimes people down through the ages have always thought that way. Then we have Job. Well, he thought God was oppressing him. He never learned the lessons by himself. He never learned it by himself. He held to his integrity and to his personal reasoning. Then we have Elihu in the five chapters 32 through 37. He saw Job's problem of upholding his own righteousness. Elihu saw it in part. Then we have finally God who speaks. Was Job's problem because of self-righteousness? Well, God never said that. God never accused Job. He demanded that Job give an answer. I won't tell you, you tell me. God never directly gave the answer to Job's problem. God had confidence in Job from the beginning. I declare the end from the beginning. I was considering my servant Job. God proved to Satan that Job was a faithful servant. It was for Job's good what he went through. Paul would say that in Romans 8:28. That all things work to the good to those who obey God and love God. Like Job, we must all come to see the big picture, as he did in the last chapter, that God is fully in charge and knows what he is doing and what he is allowing to take place. We must have confidence that he knows what he is doing and what he is allowing in our lives and in his church as well in this New Testament age. That's true because you read the scriptures in the New Testament. Talk about that. Romans 8, I'll talk about it. 1 Peter chapter 4, where people have suffered persecution. We read in the last Bible study, 1 Peter 4, 12 through 19, Christ suffered worse and he was innocent. God has everything. It is done for a purpose and for a reason. It's an interesting story we can learn from, and every time we do go back through it, maybe we'll see more things that we can learn from that experience. It is not our integrity. It's not our righteousness. It is God living in us, Jesus Christ living his life in us. He did know of his Redeemer will come. He talked about that, did he not? There in both chapter 19 of the book of Job. I know my Redeemer lives, who will redeem me. Yes, it's not yours, Job, and it's not ours. We have to give the credit where the credit is due. That is to God and to his Savior and our head and our Redeemer, Jesus Christ.